You're listening to Earthbeat, our impact on our planet.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Many of us find it a comforting thought that when we die, our bodies return to the soil and feed the circle of life. Sadly, the reality is a little less romantic, and that's causing problems, as our EnviroMinute explains.
Earthbeat's EnviroMinute.
Your body may be a temple, but it's also toxic waste. There is cadmium in your liver, lead in your bones, and mercury in your tooth fillings. When you die, this creates problems. The ground surrounding graveyards often becomes polluted, and contaminants can leach into the water supply. It's not just the body that goes into a hole in the ground. As part of the burial, we add many other hazards, from concrete to toxic paint and metals. But don't think cremation's any better. During the burning process, all the pollutants are released into the atmosphere. A single body isn't a huge burden on the environment, but think about it. A global population of almost 7 billion now means 7 billion bodies in 100 years' time, and that's an awful lot of funerals.
EnviroMinute from Radio Netherlands Worldwide.
So on this edition of Earthbeat, we're looking at the footprint of the final journey. Different cultures take a very different approach to disposing of their dead, but according to Joe Sihe of the Green Burial Council, modern-day burial techniques are often unnecessarily polluting to the environment. Joe spoke to me from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and started by explaining how a green burial can do it better.
Well, green burial is burial that can take place without the use of toxic chemicals, without contributing to waste. It essentially has come to be defined as burial without the use of metal caskets, concrete burial vaults, and embalming fluid using toxic chemicals. But everything has its environmental externalities. We bury in this country about 800,000 gallons of a known carcinogen, formaldehyde, in the ground because of embalming. We bury so much metal, I calculated, in caskets that we could rebuild the Golden Gate Bridge each year, and we bury more concrete, 1.6 million tons, as a result of burial vaults to construct a two-lane highway from New York to Detroit. So there's a tremendous carbon footprint with that, obviously, and so we're just providing options for families who want to make sure their last act is not one, an act of pollution, and where possible actually contributes to some healing on the planet.
Are most people aware of what goes into a grave, apart from the body?
I don't think most people have really wanted to peek behind the curtain. Quite frankly, I think some of the ickier aspects of death care have protected it. And what's happened is I think green burial provides a context for people to want to think and talk about death and death care. And we've learned that it actually provides solace, you know, allowing people to know that they're going to live and die and decay and be reborn in some fashion is okay. But that's not what's been going on. The death care in this part of the world, and there aren't too many parts of the world where it is done this way, about six or seven countries, but really in America, death care has been about impeding the process of decay and regeneration.
Why is that?
Well, I think it plays into our interest in sanitation that came about in the mid-20th century, what I often refer to as the better dying through chemistry era. We set up this alienation between the decedent and the family, and I think the medical community, quite frankly, did it first. And a lot of aspects of death care are icky to some. We've propped up a myth in this country that the body is protected from the elements through chemicals that it's infused with and a metal casket that's sealed and then another big box made out of concrete. The fact is anaerobic bacteria does its thing and body tissues liquefy, body cavities burst.
This is the icky stuff you were talking about.
This is the icky stuff. We're seeing people return to the way most of humanity has cared for its dead for thousands of years.
Now, not all cultures go in for burial, and I'm wondering about the alternatives. For example, how green is cremation?
The Green Burial Council has been trying to stay away from a good, better, and best approach. I think cremation, for example, has been badly diminished by some people in the green burial movement. They know something's coming out of a smokestack, and they're concerned about that. But we actually hired an environmental planning firm to help us put together an offset program and discovered that it took about a $4 contribution to a carbon fund to offset the typical cremation. That's not a lot of CO2 compared to what we expend in our daily lives, heating and cooling our homes and driving our cars around. But it does matter to some people, and offsetting is being done. We need to be careful. I'm a former Jesuit lay minister and officiant, and as I like to say, you know, ritual cannot be dictated or codified or handed over to us on any sort of platter, even a non-toxic biodegradable one, if it's to really work. And we really need to back off and let people do what they think is the most appropriate thing to honor the dead, heal the living, and invite in the divine.
Because it is a sensitive issue.
That's right. You know, I think it's really rotten to make people feel bad about having embalmed their mother or cremated their father. I think we need to educate people so they make good decisions and understand that whatever they want can be done in a more environmentally sustainable manner.
Coming up on the program, we'll be hearing more from Joe Sihe, and we'll be investigating those more sustainable options, including this controversial choice from Taiwan.
This is no pun intended, but he said, at the moment, this is an excellent idea, but it is dead.
To find out what he's talking about, stay with us. You're listening to Earthbeat. I'm Marnie Chesterton. As you heard from Joe Sihe earlier, there's real room for improvement in the funeral industry. And maybe this involves taking a more practical attitude to disposing of bodies. One crematorium in Taiwan has even figured out a way of generating electricity from the heat coming out of the ovens. But in this conservative Buddhist island, the idea is agitating some age-old superstitions. I spoke to correspondent Keith Perron in Taipei, and he explained exactly what the crematorium was up to.
Well, it is very interesting. Effectively, what they're doing is the ovens that perform the cremations generate heat of around 1,000 degrees centigrade. And when this funeral parlor, which is funeral parlor number 2, went under some renovations last year, they decided to install a system which effectively takes the heat, heats up water, the water turns to steam, and then that turns a turbine, which then turns a generator, and then produces electricity to run the air conditioning, the lights in the offices, including a cafe that they have at the funeral parlor.
Okay, and just to be clear, this isn't burning bodies to make electricity.
No, all it's doing is using the heat from the ovens to generate electricity. The bodies that are inside the oven are not involved in this process at all. This funeral parlor, by the way, does do around 52 to 55 cremations a day. So if the oven is running at 1,000 degrees centigrade through almost the entire day, you can imagine how much electricity that does generate.
Okay. So despite the fact that it's not directly the corpses that are being turned into electricity, this is still causing a stir amongst the residents of Taipei.
It's causing a stir only because one of Taipei city councillors, he brought up in the Taipei City Council, he said that this was really bad. This was showing no feelings towards the mourners and the families of the people who have passed on. And then all of a sudden, in one of the local Taiwan newspapers, they ran a headline. And if you translate the headline from Chinese into English, it basically means mourners wait while drinking cappuccino and their loved ones are being used to provide energy.
I can see that that's a tad insensitive, but is there an element of the belief that sort of specifically says your loved ones can't be useful as a source of electricity?
There isn't anywhere in Buddhist scripture, well, at least the Buddhist scripture here in Taiwan, that says that. But some of the local politicians and the Taiwan media are playing this song. Unfortunately, Fortunately, it's also a generational thing as well. Usually people of a certain generation are much more superstitious. So even though the bodies themselves are not being used to generate electricity, the fact that the oven is doing the cremation has caused enough people to feel extremely uncomfortable about this.
And has everyone reacted poorly, or are there some people who are recognizing the environmental benefit, or indeed the economic benefit of doing this?
Depends on generation. One of the local Taiwan newspapers did a poll, and they discovered that 70% of the people polled were against this idea. And then they mentioned that, you know, the people that were polled were over 50 years old. When they interviewed the younger generation, say under 35, it was around 63% were supporting the idea. Now, Taiwan has been very active in bringing its emission levels for the following year, 2010, down to the levels of 2007. And this is a government plan. At the same time, people are looking at the aspect of saving money. Now, when I spoke to the director of the funeral parlor, he said that prior to having the system installed, they were spending roughly around $324 a day. Since they've had the system installed, it's less than $92 a day. So people now, the younger generation, and even some of the older generation that are, you know, very superstitious, are looking at this as a way of saving money. It's better for the environment. It reduces CO2 emissions. And now they're thinking, is this the way to go? Not just with funeral parlors, but also in other fields as well, like smelting, for example.
Keith, will superstition win out over environmental good sense?
Well, the way Taiwan works is that this is going to cause some controversy for a little while, but then people will look at the savings. Eventually, superstition will be put aside, but it takes a little time to make that change here in Taiwan.
Keith Perron in Taipei, thank you very much.
This is Earthbeat, the show that's never on standby. Stay tuned.
Researchers in Taiwan have been trying to create lighting as efficient as LEDs without using the toxic, expensive phosphor powder that LEDs rely on. And they've stumbled across a brilliantly odd idea. Implant the leaves of trees with gold particles. The idea is to bring man's innovation and nature together to eventually use nanotechnology in trees to replace street lights, reducing both light pollution and carbon emissions, as well as cutting electricity costs. Earthbeat correspondent Keith Perron is in Taiwan and joins me to tell me more. Now, Keith, I love Taiwan as a source of crazy ideas, and this is about as good as they get. Trees that glow like streetlights. How did that come about?
Many people may not know, but Taiwan has said that they want to reduce their emissions in the next few years. They want to reduce it dramatically. So that means using less oil and gas to produce electricity, which is mainly now being produced by oil and gas. So they came up with this idea. They thought, well, look, if we have trees in parks, the trees are there. Why don't we make the trees light up?
And where did the inspiration for this crazy idea come from?
Well, they've had the inspiration for a while, but then some of the researchers went to see the movie Avatar by James Cameron. There's this one romantic scene in the movie where they're in the forest and all the trees are lighting up. And they watched this scene and they thought, you know, we could really do this.
I know it's nanotechnology and probably very complicated, but can you give me a brief overview of how it works?
Basically, what they've decided to do is they tried to create a tree that can illuminate. And in some ways, it's almost like changing the genetic makeup of a tree to inject it with what it needs. So the tree itself, once it grows and has these leaves, say the leaves are glowing, but then the fall time comes along, the leaves fall away. But then in the springtime, when the leaves grow back, the tree itself can automatically produce this genetic compound to make the leaves glow. The leaves actually do glow. I mean, it is very, very strange to see. It is almost like you said, you know, something from Hollywood.
And so you've actually seen these trees close up?
I've seen these trees at the Taipei International Floral Expo, and a lot of people, when they saw it on television the first time, thought, oh, they just put little tiny little LEDs, strap them on the back of leaves, and that's how it's done. But no, it's the actual leaves that are producing the light. But I should mention, it's not like they're really bright enough to illuminate a whole area. It's also important to point out that the tree itself, the brightness of the tree also depends on the amount of daylight and UV light that they get during the day. But imagine, Marnie, a whole park with these trees, or a road, you know, with the divider down the center, with these trees lighting up the streets. The possibilities are quite amazing.
Yeah, I'm suddenly beginning to feel quite sorry for the birds that might want to sleep in the trees.
Yeah, exactly. Or the owls. They wouldn't know what time of day it was, you know?
Exactly. So, what was the reaction from people at the expo?
Well, the reaction is kind of odd. When I went there and spoke to people, most people thought it was strange. And there were two girls that I spoke to, and they really summarized it of what most people think.
I find it really weird because the tree doesn't glow. It feels like something strange is changing inside the tree.
It's pretty cool to see a tree that can glow. Cool.
Well, Marnie, as we heard from the two girls there, I mean, that's pretty much the consensus. People think it's weird, but it's also really cool. It's sort of, you know, split down the middle. But even the people that think it's weird think it's a great idea. It's just, it is odd when you see it. There was an American guy who I came across at the expo, and I said, what do you think of those trees? What comes to mind? And this is what he had to say.
It sounds like the opening of a good science fiction horror movie, or maybe a Michael Crichton novel. Okay, when I was in college, people started doing their hair with reds and greens and blues. Think about what they could do with that. Think about what it might do for the porn industry.
Think about what it might do for the porn industry.
Exactly. Now, I'm not going to say anything on that one.
Thank you very much. Keith Perron in Taiwan. On that note, we'll say thanks and goodbye. Joining us on the line from Taipei is Keith Perron. Keith, welcome to the programme.
Hello, Marnie.
Keith, that's a noise I associate with ice cream.
You couldn't be more mistaken. But, you know, we have to set the scene. Imagine this, you know, you're visiting me. It's a beautiful, hot, sunny day outside. The sky is blue, the air is clean, but we're very, very hot. You hear that come by, and I could just picture what you would say. You would say, Keith, oh, I am dying for an ice cream. The only way that I would be able to respond to you is to say, well, Marnie, you can at least have the wrapper, because that is not an ice cream truck. That, in fact, is a garbage truck, a very smelly garbage truck.
Okay, and can you explain exactly why the garbage trucks in Taipei play Beethoven?
This goes back a number of years. Here in Taipei, maybe 15 years ago or so, there was a problem with garbage piling up in the streets because the garbage collection would maybe be done in the late afternoon. So people would go to work, leave their garbage outside, and it would be there outside all day in the hot sun. It was garbage everywhere on a lot of the street corners. So the city decided, look, we have to do something to clean this up. So they came up with a system where the garbage truck will pass by twice a day, except on Sundays, three times on Saturdays, play that piece of music 10 minutes before the truck actually stops at a certain corner, which tells people, okay, it's now time for me to get my garbage bag, go downstairs, and throw it in the back of the truck. Because now here in Taipei, you cannot just leave your garbage in the street. You can only bring your garbage down to the street when you hear that piece of music.
So people just need to keep their ears open for that piece of music, and then that means leg it downstairs and run after the garbage truck.
That's right. The garbage trucks will stop at certain intersections that are busy. And it's quite amusing because just before the garbage truck passes, maybe 5 or 10 minutes before, you see like these little crowds of people everywhere. They look like mini protests, except everybody's holding garbage bags.
Keith, what on earth is that?
That is a very traditional Japanese children's song. It's a very old folk song. And when they started to recycle, have a recycling program here in Taipei, they thought, well, we need to have a truck that goes by and plays a different piece of music so people know what to bring down to the street. So now when people hear that on certain days of the week, they know it's time to bring down their paper products and cardboard.
But do you think it works? I mean, are the streets of Taipei now rat-free?
At the beginning, there was a little bit of a problem because of the schedule of the garbage trucks. Now, for example, in my area, the garbage truck comes by at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and then again at 7, which is difficult for people that are working all day. So what people were doing was going to the public trash cans and leaving their garbage there. And the garbage trash cans just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then the garbage problem started to come back until the city came along and said, you know what, we're going to remove all the city trash cans. So they did that. The streets now are extremely clean, and nobody would dare bring their garbage down, just leave it, and then go away. Because now, you know, there's a stigma that's attached to it. So if you do that, either you'll get a fine, or people will say that you're very dirty for just leaving your garbage there. Why don't you just bring it down at the normal times? But the problem is when you can bring it down. Like, for example, myself, I am not home until late in the evening, which is a common problem with a lot of people. The woman that I spoke to who lives in my neighborhood, Julia Chen, she summarizes it very well, how it's good for some people and bad for others. And you'll understand why after we take a listen to it.
I think it really depends on the situation, because when I work in downtown, I work from 9 to 6, and when I go home, it's already too late to catch the garbage truck, so I have to leave the whole week garbage until the weekend to throw it away. It was so disgusting.
Yeah, this is really bad if you're not in the right place at the right time, or if you're deaf and you can't hear the special music.
And many times, which is a very funny sight, is you'll see two people on a scooter, one sitting behind holding two garbage bags, chasing the garbage truck as it's going down the street because they didn't run down in time.
And it's not just those two songs, is it? There's a third song played by garbage trucks. And let's just have a quick listen of this. I can't place it, but that sounds really familiar to me.
Well, that's a very famous American folk song called Red River Valley. Why they chose that is beyond me. But on certain days of the week, when that truck goes by, it means it's time to bring down your plastic and glass bottles for recycling.
I'm just imagining it like a version of mobile phone ringtones, that they could kind of have some show where they change the garbage truck ringtones every month according to what people voted for.
Well, there are some people here in Taipei that I've heard when their mobile phone rings, that is playing one of those songs.
No, so they don't have enough of it from having to hear it every day.
They don't have enough of it. And it's, like I said, it's become such a part of the culture now. And one guy told me, he said his son is learning piano. And he said his son is a big fan of Beethoven, but he said, I forbid my son to play this because I'm so tired of hearing it all day long. And it's the same with the Japanese folk song. In a lot of the primary schools and kindergartens, they would teach this to children, but they don't teach it anymore because of the connection now to bring out the garbage. And if they did teach it, kids would just start laughing.
That's Keith Perron in Taipei.